This is Frank Olkin. I'm calling the Ontolog teleconference for November 19th to order. And our topic is the standardization process for the QOMO standard, Quantities and Units of Measure Ontology Standard. Our first speaker, I believe, is Howard Mason.
Howard's here. Hopefully you can hear me.
Yes, we can.
Right. Okay, the purpose this morning, my bit, is to look at the charter and the timescales that we would have to achieve. And having just had an email from the PC coordinator at OASIS saying just how close we're running it, I'd invite you to scroll down to the list of material and click on item 1B, which is a set of slides, before we go through the charter itself. You will find a title slide, which you can ignore, and I'm hoping Jamie will unmute himself and jump in here if I've got any of this wrong. If you look at the second slide, the milestones in setting up an OASIS TC start from when we actually submit the TC charter, which is sent into OASIS with copies to the participants and the representatives of the organization that's going to we're going to support this activity. Then not later than 5 days after this, OASIS will decide whether the charter meets their rules and either recycle it back to the proposers or send it out for a review around the membership. That's a 14-day period which starts within 5 days of the submission. Okay? After the comment period closes, which is on this no later than 19 days after we do the submission, there's 4 days to sort out a telecom where the convener, OASIS, and the proposers can get together to review the comments. Within that, 4 weeks, 28 days after the initial submission, that is your final deadline for amending the proposal. And that needs to address any comments that have been raised against it. And then following that deadline, if there are no further issues, OASIS will post the call for participation and the date of the first meeting. Now, if we're holding a telecom first meeting, that meeting has to be at least 30 days after the call for participation goes out. And you have a drop-dead time of 7 days before that meeting to declare that you wish to, as an eligible person, to participate. Jamie, am I okay so far?
Generally, although I may have a comment or two at the end on how this all actually works.
Okay. If you flip to the other slide, to the third slide, you'll see what that means if we backschedule from our original date and take weekends into account. If we plan to meet on the 14th of January, then registration has to take place by the 7th of January. The notice period for the first meeting implies that notice must go out by the 15th of December. And that's now where we really start squeezing down below the maxima that I've highlighted in the slide. 12th and 13th of December are a weekend. So if you look further down the slide, you'll see that if OASIS can post not later than Wednesday of next week, the comment period closes on the 9th, and we have only a couple of days within which to turn the proposal around. That leaves a very limited period for discussing and resolving comments. And that occurs if we can submit the charter to OASIS tomorrow. So we are right up against the absolute limit of what we can achieve within the OASIS rules, and even that is assuming that we don't take the full time that's available. Jamie, would you like to comment?
If I may, thanks. What happens in these cases, first of all, OASIS undertakes to return things within certain deadlines. the reason that we don't promise it a final date, and the reason that the final date from the first thing we set at the time of posting, is because we have a number of periods of time that we prepare to maintain public openness. For example, we don't want a meeting until 30 days after the final posting of the official notice that would allow the world to show up. The immediate problem you have here, I took Howard's slides, which he's good enough to share in advance, and made a few comments and sent them on to my successor as the Director of Standards for OASIS, who is the official minder of RTC process, Ray McRae. And really what she came back with to Howard was just a warning that you can send this with this date, but depending on whether there are comments, depending on whether there's slippage, depending on whether anything happens, unexpected holidays, day counting, could very easily change. So really, my advice is the same thing was the last time we talked about this, to wit, be prepared to have the intended first date slip a week or two, depending on you know, who shows up, how it all comes out, whether there's further requests for change. Now, as a practical matter, requests for change come when somebody in the LASIS community thinks that it's either not comprehensive to the outside, or thinks you maybe ought to at least mention or explain your relationship to something else, or thinks that the relationship to something else is misstated or somehow inadvisable. And so there is a feedback loop, and I'd say the likelihood that you'd have no comments and no reaction either from staff or our community is rather low. And that's why I think she's saying, Howard, that you should expect a bit of comeback and the ability to have to circle back around. In the interest of that, let me tell you that we usually do in OASIS TC formation is that the convener, in this case, Howard has been good enough to volunteer for that role. Volunteer. Maybe I should get back to the word dragoon, but I'll leave that alone. What we rely on at OASIS is that if there are minor changes, the convener will go back to the process and check with the other proponents to make sure that all the people who are signing the thing as a co-sponsor and actually supporting it are pleased with those changes. But the group should be prepared for a small delta of a few words, a couple mentions of things, there's a question about why this versus that. People tend not to touch the technical content because really the submitters are the experts. But in terms of how it relates to the rest of the world and how it might constrain the TC and what that really means, you should expect feedback, and that's why, to say it one last time, it's likely that there will be some date slippage. Now, having said that, I also have, from having butt heads with staff a bit, two things I noted in the draft that Howard has provided that I want to mention before I'm unfortunately forced to leave this off the hour, where these are the sorts of things where the feedback you will get, and you might as well hear it now rather than later. But I just want to make sure that at the end of this, the group is comfortable with a process that allows Howard as the convener proponent to work with you, not necessarily in a large number of complex meetings, to make any final refinements so that he leaves this meeting or whatever future meeting you have with the authority to file rough edges and to have things clarified, subject to keeping the group advised. Done. Thanks.
Thank you. If there are no further questions on the process, I noticed one from Matthew on what's an eligible person. Well, if you now go to 1A, which is the draft charter as updated, you'll find the link to the top of the page, which will take you to the full technical committee process and define eligible persons for you. Just a very quick note on what I've done to the charter. You should be able to all see it now. We've pluralized the title. Based on the comments on Monday, we've made and the very good input from Ed, thank you, plus a little bit of license, I've updated 1B and 1C to be a little clearer. And the rest of the document, we've gone through and put in comments that were made at the October meeting and have been made since. What I've done is also to, down in 2D, put in a full list of members, which I see have been edited somewhat, thank you. We need to finalise that, and as Mary McRae has noted in her email to us, we need to fill in and get the necessary statements of support from the primary representatives of each of the organisations represented here. And we need to do that before we submit the documents, unless Jamie corrects me otherwise. So with that, I think I'll, Frank, it's probably worthwhile opening the charter for to receive further comments.
I will say this, Howard, you wouldn't want to send it in with a list and then discover that your people weren't able to get the approval they need.
Absolutely. So we need to...
I'm not quite clear on... Are you asking me to do something right now?
Oh, I think I'm opening suggesting you open the meeting for people to make any comments they wish to on the charter.
Oh, okay. So, it looks like Peter Yim wants to speak. But in general, if anyone has, they can either put their comments in via the chat room or they can raise their hand. In the chat room if they want to speak. Peter, why don't you go ahead and speak?
Yes, I among others, I was one of the people who edited your list of participants based on previous exchanges, in particularly the October 30th face-to-face at NSF. That said, I guess it's clear now that you wanted people to come in with a statement of support. So my question is, we saw one from Jerry Smith just earlier this morning. Let me ask Howard or Jamie, would a statement like that suffice? Or do you need company like institutional letterhead and wet signature and stuff like that?
Peter's
I'll defer to Jamie on that because they didn't have that requirement when I last set up an Oasis PC.
Peter, it's the informal sort of thing is fine. Jerry is the Oasis representative for his organization, and thus if he says it's good, it's good, it's sort of thing. But I will make sure that I send it back to the EOM ontolog list today a reference to exactly the process for that. But it is not that demanding.
All right.
And my hand's up for another purpose when we get that one.
Great. So my next question will be, given that, then maybe we should say the list that is on the charter is a tentative list until you get acknowledgments at least on the UOM list or on email confirming a participant, and then before you submit, you will finalize the list. Would that
proper
be
proper confirmation? Yeah, proper confirmation is the way I'd put it for now.
And I'd note that we can actually cut down the list to the number where we actually have approvals, and then extend it at a later stage before the final submission in 23 or whatever day's time.
Okay. So you have. I think it's Howard I need to address this to. I've been given email authorization to act on behalf of Lawrence Berkeley Lab. So Lawrence Berkeley Lab will participate in this.
I guess if you forward me that email, I can then fill in with confidence the line that I have for Gary, and we'll fill in 2E with those who are actually confirmed.
I think I just did forward you that email. But if not, post your email address on the chat room and I'll try again. Okay.
Okay. Thank you. I have it.
Okay. Good.
So we have 2 out of 3 institutional members. So we need 5 people from 3, if I remember certainly right.
Yeah, you have mine, and I'm an individual member. Peter Yim here. I'm an individual member, although not an institutional member.
Ed, question for Ed Dartmoor. Do we have NIST in? Please unmute.
I said it on the chat line. Yeah, this is, and this is officially an I have management approval and my voting rep does.
Okay. Let's need one more.
Well, can I still be heard, Howard?
Yep.
Yes, you can be heard.
Yeah, just so you know, if you have, I think you may already be there. We'll be happy to take more, but the requirement is not five people with diversity of organization.
Okay, we have three organizations plus one individual.
So if one of those organizations, I'm just checking the rules here to make sure I'm up on chapter and verse, but if one of those organizations puts the second person on, that gets you five people from three organizations, doesn't it?
Yep.
So, you know, let's continue to work on other people who are willing to participate, but that doesn't look like you're going to have a problem there. And as Howard said, then over time, as the thing progresses, we add to it based on folks who are able to confirm afterwards.
I should think, Howard, that you'll have no trouble getting your staff to commit.
We can probably hope so. I've just seen on the chat room that Hans Peter is unlikely to be able to join Oasis, so we don't have any there. Is there anybody else on the call, on the list, who can give us a commitment now?
I believe it's Steve Ray did say that he was working on one, and Rob Raskin, we did check that NASA is an Oasis member, and unfortunately, neither of them are on the call now, but both are potentially there.
May I ask? I apologize, Frank and Howard. I have to depart, as I said, now for another call in a moment, and I want to just mention something before I do.
Go ahead.
I think you're well on your way. But two things which I will try and get also off in written form. That we noticed in the revision to the draft charter, which we'll be going through in detail on this call. One is that the paragraph, which is numbered 22DU, Dog Universe, which starts with the development will be coordinated with, you should expect that staff will reply if you phrase it that way. That development will be coordinated with sounds like more of a commitment than you can actually make at the outset to join work, and rather we should say that the TC will seek to coordinate with, or that those things will influence, or, you know, there needs to be something, the sentence the development will be coordinated with will need to be something that does not seem to create a binding commitment if read the wrong way.
Seeks to coordinate with sounds good. I will adapt
like
the wording there.
Right, let's see, and you might even, so there's a list at the bottom here of, let's see, where is it, in 2E, yeah, to some extent, what this really is it's a description of, you might look at section 2A, Howard, which is traditionally rather where we put the liaisons, you know, the folks with whom we think we want to coordinate, and where this quite really belongs, whether or not you repeat it up there, is also somewhere in 2A, where the TC is the undertaking. You know, we will talk to these other people in an attempt to, you know, reconcile, liaison, whatever it is that you plan to do. The other substantive thing I wanted to mention is that in section, let's see, is it 1H? No, it's section 2H. Contributions of existing technical work to the proposals will be made to this TC. Be aware that most of those things are, as I understand them, actually things that you will use, reference, and coordinate with, and perhaps profile, but they are not going to be contributed to the TC. Realistically, I don't think that somebody's going to give to Oasis the right to have and change Vim or Perf or any one of those things. But rather, I think those are, the only be a place for starting work. You know, here is material that the TC is going to use as a starting point and then actually actively modify rather than improve. And I think these are rather also in that class of liaison things that, like your list in up at the scope, I was mentioning a minute ago, and like the stuff that's supposed to be in Section 2A, these are matters with which you intend to be concerned, standards that you may reference, reuse, or consider, et cetera. But they're not contributions. Contribution is when somebody has the rights over the Oasis on a non-exclusive basis to actually mess with this stuff. And I don't think your TC is actually planning to change or take over or any of the items in your current Section 2H. Howard, is that sufficiently clear? Am I making sense there?
Absolutely. I was merely using the words that were left in the charter the template charter unchanged, and something like it is anticipated that the following activities will serve as reference material for this activity.
Right, and reference material has the unfortunate ambiguity of being essentially a statement that it raises the question about whether the TC is permitted to not use all of those things and therefore would be permitted to modify them or vary from them in any way. You see, this is a bit like the may, must, shall, might problem. Howard, if we say this reference material...
Do you understand a set of words?
Well, up in Section 2A, we don't say contribution. We say this is a similar or applicable work that is being used in other organizations, and we anticipate evaluating it for potential use. We anticipate the TC will consider reusing. Or if you mean to be a boundary, you would say up in the scope, up in the first section, this output must use. Just as you're saying, they're going to create some OLDL. They're going to create some CLIF. You could say they're going to use VIM or whatever. But I don't think that would...
I'll put some appropriate words around that.
Right. Okay, thanks. Those are the two things you hear from us. Definitely is the development phrase up in scope and the problem with calling those things a 2H contribution. And again, I do apologize for jumping the queue. I just am trying to be in too many places today.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you all.
Okay. Well, any other
comments? Is Jim's hand still up? Does he still have something to say? Okay. So, Howard, did you have anything further to say before we go on to the other folks on the agenda?
I'm really looking for any other contributions before we finalize the content.
Oh, Howard, did you see the remark in the chat room by Hajo Reisersberg? 1401. He wanted some more.
Yeah, I think we're now at the stage where I'm looking for explicit word changes.
Okay, so maybe Hajo can actually supply some alternative wording to you. Just on the... Okay. And then I guess we're not going to hear from Ed today. Once we wrap up this section, then I think David Leal will be next. Is he on the line? Yeah, it looks like it.
Well, the question around the group is, are people reasonably happy with subject to queries, to any input from Harjo, and the comments from Jamie that this goes forward as the charter on the basis of Berkeley, NIST, and Peter Yim, and I noticed Ed has put me down. I still don't have consent from the company, but I guess I can throw it in order to get things started.
Yes.
If there are no other comments, then how do we want to take this forward? I'll make those changes, and then we can submit the text formally to Oasis for their review.
Yeah, I move we do that.
Sounds good to me. You should probably post the revised text to the weekly.
I will update the update the text probably later tonight, whenever I get the input from Herschel, and it will be there on the wiki. I'm out of the office tomorrow, so it's then down effectively to, I think to Peter to forward it to Mary McRae and to the individuals that are noted.
You mean Peter Yim?
Yeah, if he could.
I'm
going to be effectively offline from 9 a.m. to 9 p.m. UK time tomorrow.
Okay, I'll be happy to do that.
Peter, are you amenable?
Hang on.
I'm not hearing anything from Peter.
Sorry, I was on mute. Yes, I'll be happy to do that.
Okay.
Yeah, there is one little editing problem, which is that the OASIS rule says it's a plain text file, so all the fancy bracket NID stuff will have to come out from the final version. But I guess with the time zones that we have in place, we could do the submission kind of your close of business your time rather than close of business mine. So we can at least review the contents before it goes and fix any final issues before it goes out. Okay?
Yep.
We've just had a comment coming out from Ohio saying it says existing formal models for quantities and units are not quite comparable. I think that was the issue is one that we've discussed where there are different systems of units which are not necessarily compatible and derived the same way. Again, if there are revised words, happy to listen to them.
Okay. I think we should consider this part of the business completed and move on to the next agenda item unless anyone has an objection. And the next person on the agenda would be David Leal talking about the units of measure ontology standard UML model draft. David? Well, first of all, is there any objection to proceeding?
Yep.
Okay. David, do you want to take over the meeting from this point and speak about your work on the UOM model based on BIM?
Okay. I mean, not going to do too much technical detail. It's just sort of summarizing where we are and sort of the flavour of the discussion so far. So if you go on to the next overhead, I notice that the numbers that you're displaying are not as I numbered them. Come up as 22. So as part of the discussion, looking at the overhead, it's differences between the discussion which sort of came with sort of some vigor over the summer was based in terms of sorting out some of the concepts within the VIM, and the particular problems all lay at the top in terms of there's a definition of quantity within the VIM and kind of quantity, and the definitions seem to overlap and quantity seems to cover a number of different things. So if you could go on a little bit, go on to the next one, and then the one after in the overheads. So what I said is that the top objects there are all rather similar. And as a result of the discussions, perhaps we can think of some slightly different terms for them. But you're in the Vimbas kind of quantity, and there's a feeling that we understand what kinds of quantity are, and by and large they're the things in ISO 1000. We then have what I've called here physical properties. It's the 101, it's all the engineering detail, so that we've got things like radius and all different types of material properties and all the things which occur in engineering, you know, in a physical couple like waist size and inside leg. They're all things which have a different domain, and there are many millions of these, as opposed to the kinds of quantity which are many fewer. And then we have a lot of the concept of the particular property, which is the actual occurrence of this in the real world. And so the particular properties is another sort of example of what was within the scope of quantity in the VIM. So it was these three concepts at the top, physical property, particular property, and kind of quantity, were all not separated out as separate terms within the VIM in a way which was clear to us. And it's a lot of where the discussion and work over the summer was. As you go down into more of the, well, maybe down in the star gun, but down into more of the detailed areas, such as systems of units, systems of quantities, things become much more straightforward. And the particular thing is that at the bottom there is a straightforward concept of quantity value, which the VIM defines as being a number and a reference, where the reference can be to a unit of measure or to a scale or to something else. So it was a very generic concept of, could be a reference for test procedure. A very, so the quantity value became a very generic concept. And then one of the things which has been added into the diagram, which is not within the VIM, is the concept of a magnitude of quantity, because the quantity value is explicitly within the VIM a number and a reference which expresses the magnitude of something, although there has to be a box which is the something. So as in the example shown here, you've got 5.34 meters, well, that's quantity value, but there is a length which is expressed as 5.34 meters or as 16 feet or whatever, so that these will be different expressions of the same magnitude. So the work over the summer was very much looking at the sort of top area of the model and expressing it in terms of the UML diagram. If we go on to the next one.
Could you give us a slide number so we can make sure we're all in
scale? Well, I've got slide numbers, but your slide numbers are different. I don't know what has exactly happened. It's not slide 55. Ah, it might well be slide 5. I'm not quite sure. There must be differences between PowerPoint.
Your slide numbers are just duplicated, so 55 is slide 5.
Okay, that's straightforward. And so one of the things I think is significant to us is the need to separate out what or physical property here, which is the sort of engineeringness from the kind of quantity. And I mean, there's an example here where if you do a material test, you extract three stresses, which is the upper yield strength, the delicate tensile strength, and indeed a number of others. you know, you read the thing to understand what they mean by a kind of quantity. It's defined as something which is quantities which are mutually comparable. And I think that what they are trying to say is, well, stress is the object we can do arithmetic with, whereas the others are different sorts of things, and perhaps understood as relationships between the test procedure and the stress value. If you can go on a bit, please. It's just one of the things that I think we're going to have to do is to understand how to deal with the engineering richness side as opposed to the quantities. One possible way is to think of this is in terms of the properties of certain functions, but that's something which I think is going to come out of the work as we go ahead. Let's go on again. And the key thing which struck me as important, which came up over the summer, was a bringing together of a number of ideas by Barkmeyer, who realized that the word kind of quantity is itself being used in two quite different ways. And this again has a relationship to is whether when we're talking about length, we're talking about particular instances of quantity and applying the kind to that. So I'm going to give an example here. It was particular, using length as a kind for particular values of length. These are instances of length in the real world. And always going on to the next one, which will be understanding kind as a class of magnitude, so that we have length as saying that 37 inches and 31 inches are, which are both abstract concepts, are both of the same kind, are both of type length. And so that was understanding kind in two different ways, and that came out over the summer, and I think is something which the ontology development is going to have to take into account. And, that what I put, if you go on to the next one, I gave an example which was sort of illustrating what was Ed Barkmeyer's point, that we've got particular quantities of very different natures. If you go on to the next one, one view of kind of quantity is to say, right, we're regarding this as a grouping of particular quantities, and that was one possible interpretation of that of the kind of quantity I showed in the first UML diagram. To go on again, we can see a different interpretation of kind of quantity, but we can define equivalence classes of quantities. So we've got, taking the ones at the top, length equal to the distance of London to New York, there are many lengths.
There's an
underlying class of lengths. And we can then go to the next slide regarding length as a kind of quantity being the class which has all these equivalence classes as a member. And so that if we're thinking of the metre, it's possible that the meter can be regarded as an equivalence class of a particular length, and it's one, and it's the member of length as a kind of quantity where it's understood as the class containing magnitudes of quantities. So it's all got quite technical in terms of unravelling the concepts at the top, but once that's established, the relationships of between different kinds of quantity in terms of defining the relationship between mass and length and stress, for example, becomes much more straightforward.
David?
Yeah?
I'm not even sure what slide we're on. You need to, every time you change slides, you need to mention the slide number.
Well, this is slide 12.
Okay.
And so, in fact, just wrapping up now, I think that if we can go on to the next one, slide 13. But a lot of the issues which we were working on over the summer was separating out the richness of the engineering domain, so that we've got hundreds of millions of different physical properties, such as tensile, tensile strength and yield strength and inside leg measurements and waist measurements. And the kinds of quantities such as stress, length, and energy. And I don't think that we reached sort of a formal conclusions about how you separate the two. It's merely that we all know what the difference is, and we are happy to separate them. And I don't think that we actually documented the difference at any stage. But certainly in terms of how we go forward, identifying what is within scope and what is out of scope becomes extremely important. And the other thing which I think came up over the summer was also quite importantly was trying to pin down the notion of what is meant by kind or quantity. And so that again is the two understandings, one of which is that the quantities which are of the same kind are particular quantities, or whether the quantities of the same kind are particular magnitudes of quantities. So again, that's a slightly different understanding of what kind of quantity means. So that one of the conclusions here, because the conclusion here is the first part, in some ways, seems quite robust, but that's the original UMO model. But there's a number of details which, as you take it forward into a formal ontology, really need to be worked out. And the discussion over the summer sort of kicked this off, but there's quite a lot of work to be done, and that what's on the wiki surrounding UML models is a sort of initial cut of where some of the discussion over the summer got to. I hope that's what I prepared. I'm not sure. It's sort of an overview of the sort of issues which were raised by the work over the summer.
Pat, you've got your hand up. Why don't you go ahead and speak? We're not. Pat, are you trying to speak? We're not hearing you. Pat Hayes?
Star 3.
Now we can hear you, I think.
No, that's Peter Yim.
Sorry.
Okay.
Oh. Yeah. It's Pat.
Okay.
I'm afraid I'm confused. It was the parts of your UML diagram. I'm looking at slide 3 now. You've listed as difficult to separate. Indeed, I've always been unable to separate them in my mind, and I found them very confusing. And I'm not any less confused now. But maybe my problem is partly because I'm in misunderstanding or not understanding these thick black arrows on this diagram. So on slide 3 or 33, there's a generic quantity and a particular quantity. and the arc between them is labeled particular quantity house type, and the black arrow points from generic to particular.
Yes.
Right.
The only, I mean, this diagram was created very informally from the language used in the BIM, and it really, the arrows are merely how you read the sentence, pretty much.
Well, that's what I'm going to find out. Which has the, so in my language, maybe this is just a cavalry issue. If you say A has type B, you're basically saying that B is a class or category and A is a member of it. So which of these is the class and which of these?
I didn't want her to actually take it that formally, which is why I left it as vague as it is. But the example in the VIN was that there is an object. There is the object in circle A is a quantity, and they also give in the VIN an example of radius as a quantity. There's two separate examples of different meanings of quantity, which I just labelled as particular quantity and generic quantity in order to put them into different boxes. And clearly, if you've got radius of circle A, an object which is radius of circle A, and an object which is radius, it's natural to put a link between the two. And the creation of the top part of figure 3 was no more sophisticated than that.
Okay.
So I think, Pat, the answer is yes. A particular quantity is an instance of a generic quantity.
Right.
I was going to say that I would not necessarily committed to that view. It's just that the language implied that, and so therefore that was a good starting point.
Okay. As I understand this diagram, the VIN definitions for generic and particular properties are identical. They're both properties, phenomenon, body, yada, etc.
Yep.
So the VIN. Mm-hmm. The VIN doesn't distinguish them, right?
The VIN gives essentially a table of examples.
Right. So
and links the examples into generic in particular, but doesn't assign different terms to them.
Right, okay. I guess, you know, my own sort of pre-theoretic intuition would also not have made this distinction. So I'm wondering why we're making it. I mean, it seems to be... We seem to be doing a lot of work here to achieve a distinction that isn't necessary and would be clearer if we didn't have it.
Well, taking in particular on side 3, the generic quantity and the particular quantity, the particular quantities are ones which occur in a particular point in space and time. You know, they are outside the scope of standardization, whereas the generic ones are not.
I think that the way to make that distinction is to distinguish between a quantity and something like an act of measurement or a measuring event or some such thing, which is what takes place at a particular place and time, and, you know, was done by an instrument, and it will have all the particularity associated with it. But what it measures is simply a quantity. Surely. I mean, it may be inaccurately, but still, as opposed to the measurement it makes on the one hand, and what that is a measurement of on the other, it seems to me that the thing at the edge of the all arrow is a quantity, and we don't need to distinguish different degrees of particularity of those quantities. In fact, it's actually conceptually awkward to do that. It gets in the way of confusing things. But then there's a question of whether, you know, this particular quantity that I measured actually is a generic quantity or not, or a generic quantity, so it's one, and so forth. But I think
think you should be facing Christopher. He is a quantity. Because after all, that's what that surely is a kind of naive intuition about these things. I measure the length of something at a particular time, I measure its length. Right? The quantity.
I think you might well be right, but I feel that the VIM probably worked backwards in terms of analysing measurements and then deriving the proper terminology at the beginning of the document from that.
Yeah, right.
And we might well need to repeat the process.
Okay. That helps clarify, my head a little bit. I have to say, I think it's like 4 or 44, so it's like 3.
Well, that's right. The 5-3 is what's on the wiki, and then I thought that when this slide was presented last, people said, hang on, this is not understandable. So for repeating it, I changed things a bit from the wiki to give some clearer examples, but not ones taken from the VIM.
Right. My hand up is now. I'll go for my hand up.
Okay.
Hans-Peter, the comment? Phoning? Hans-Peter?
Yes, thank you. We struggled with the same problems in the SysML QUDV. And currently in our ontology, we think that the ideal way of doing it would be to specialize kind of quantity into specific, more specific quantities and just have a specialization hierarchy. But the problem is that with both UML or SysML and with DL, we cannot use metaclasses. And I think what we need to do, we need one extra level of classification in order to solve the problem and stay close to the VIM concepts. And the other problem I see in the VIM is that they use the word property in defining what a quantity is, and that is confusing as well.
Yes. By the way, for the first point, you might want to look at what Scott's SKOS people did. They also needed to have a meta-hierarchy in but they need to do an LDL, so they simply treat their classes as individuals in a way, and this would be their own theory of sub-categorization, which is a very simple theory.
Okay, and were they are they still capable to use a DL reasoner on that?
Yes, I believe so, because although it doesn't get you all the interesting feedback that you get, because all these classes are individuals. But you can kind of like GLEs are over it.
Okay, I'll have a look at that,
yeah.
So, Pat, this is Frank Holcomb. But if we make the classes into individuals, then we can't talk about instances of those classes, right?
Yes, you can. You have to have your own instance number. You have to basically reproduce the class language of the notation of DL itself as in a kind of flat theory, which as far as the logic is concerned is all that relations between individuals. But you can merge exactly because it's a very weak theory, and then you can tear it if you want to sort of tinker with it, you can.
Yeah. But that's why you need the metaclasses inside the ontology.
Yeah, basically, you have to take your meta classes, whatever how you want to go, as being the DL classes, and everything else is individuals.
Right.
But which is just basically both throwing the language away, but it doesn't even get stuff working. That's all. I just mentioned it.
Do any of these problems get fixed in OWL 2? Or an OWL 4?
Yes, OWL 2 does allow something very close to metaclasses, something that looks like metaclasses. It's done by plumbing. But yes, indeed.
So maybe, and is that in OWL 2 full or OWL 2 DL?
I think even the DL version allows metaclasses, if I remember correctly.
don't share my word on that. Don't share the sources. Because I kind of need to be on the back in detail.
Okay.
But this is Hans Peter. My understanding is that I've seen quite a lot of comments and remarks that meta classes like owl colon class cannot be used in DL, but it's not completely clear.
You can't use the owl's own defined classes, like owl class and so forth, but you can build a meta class hierarchy of your own within.
Okay.
So Pat, are you suggesting that this is the way we should to deal with these problems here?
Oh, well, Cliff has no problem at all, of course. I mean, you know, he laughs at metaclasses. But, I think it suggests that OWL2 is going to be a lot easier to do a substantial part of our work in than OWL1 is. And I think it would be a more rational choice anyway, on the grounds that it's, clearly the emerging standard that a lot of people are using.
Okay, so you're suggesting we do CLIF and then we reproduce that in OWL2 rather than attempting to do anything at all in OWL1.
Well, OWL2 is like OWL1 on steroids, so it's not that different. It's just that if you, at places where you want to do things like that metaclasses, then you almost can in OWL2, or you can flatly count in OWL1. Yeah, LDLs, yeah.
Okay, so I think that actually that sounds like a plausible idea that we should take into account as we proceed. But I think we really do need to clarify this, and we need something. I find also that the diagram 4, slide 4, otherwise known as 44, seems somewhat clearer than 3 or 33. But I think we need to work this out in detail and to have detailed definitions and examples of all this, and then formalize it in CLIF or OWL2 or something.
Yeah. Well, this is the part I'm in the throes of trying to get it to CLIF right now, which is why I've got a little freedom that I have. No, sorry.
Okay. Because I think that figure 44 makes this distinction between kind of quantity and physical property. And I think there are clearly many physical properties that have the same kind of quantity.
Yeah, although I think kind of quantity has been used, at least by some people in the email discussion threads, to mean what here called physical property. So, I mean, I think the terminology, we've got to work on getting terminology straight about that, or just about metaclass, which is terminology.
Okay. Is Rob Raskin on the line?
No.
It sounds like not.
No. Yeah, Rob sent over his regrets.
Okay.
Chip Masters and Hans Peter are both online.
So they were going to talk about the ontology standard OWL graph. Chip or Hans Peter?
Chip, you want to go first and make then. Possibly.
I don't see any slides there.
Right. Hans Peter has populated the wiki page.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, but you're soft. If you speak up or get the handset closer, that would be nice.
Is it better?
Yeah, much better.
Okay. Well, I don't have anything to show. I would ask if Hans Peter could discuss a bit what he put on the wiki page there. Unfortunately, I haven't had a chance to do much work on this yet.
Okay. Hans Peter, are you there? Do star 3 to unmute.
Okay, this is Hans Peter. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you now.
And if you can go to the link, to the wiki page that's linked named Ontology Standard OWL Draft. I put there an overview of what we have done in this seasonal QUDV ontology and a link to the OMG wiki where that is documented. And so basically, I just make a very short summary of what we have in there. So it's basically split into two different ontologies, where the first one is the base ontology with the classes and properties, and the second one is the population of individuals, or let's say a small selection of individuals in the International System of Quantities and the SI units, just as an example. Then there's the basic hierarchy of the main concepts, and then I've added at the bottom of the page a list of remarks that we have on the current state of things. One of the things I want to explain what we've done with the we distinguish between both for quantities and for units, we distinguish between simple units and base units, or simple kinds of quantity and base kind of quantity. And the difference is that we regard a base kind of quantity or a base unit as a role that is assigned within the context of a system of quantities or the context of a system of units. For instance, the SI system or the ISQ. And then a simple quantity or a simple kind of quantity or a simple unit is a kind of quantity or a unit that does not depend for its definition on any other kind of quantity or unit. So it's it separates it from a derived quantity or a derived unit. And the reason to do this is to get a precise class hierarchy. For instance, in the SI system, if you regard kilogram as a what we do is we regard it as a conversion based unit because it's a prefixed unit. We need first to define the concept of a simple unit called gram, then we need a prefix called kilo, which has a factor 10 to the power 3, and then we can construct a kilogram, which then a derived or no is a prefixed unit. And then within the context of the SI system of units, we can assign it to be a base unit. And then from these concepts, we are able to, in a mechanical way, so in an automated way, to produce an algorithm that we have written in OCL that precisely defines how to derive the quantity dimension for any given kind of quantity within a given system of quantities. And the advantage of this is that we are not presupposing anything on what base quantities or base units you use. You can use also derived units or derived quantities as your base units or base quantities, and you can construct any kind of system of units or any kind of system of quantities like that. Then I have a small remark on what we do with the scales, where basically we have kinds of quantity that have scale, like temperature scales. And we think that we need a mechanism to declare the equivalency of scale value definitions in different scales in order to relate those scales. So thereby you're capable of automatically deriving how to do a unit or value conversion or magnitude conversion or specific value conversion between two quantities of the same kind or the same the same kind, which and you can convert the unit values. Then the last remark is on what we just discussed before on the metaclassing. We have a specialized quantity kind class, which is basically replicating specialization or subclassing explicitly in the ontology, in the Bayes ontology, and the reason is that in UML we need to have strict separation between the meta levels, so we want to keep the whole library or the instantiation of this on one level, and that's why we are replicating specialization explicitly in the data model. That's more or less what I want to say.
Oh, so what you said here, what I said is apparently mistaken, that in L to DL you can't use metaclasses.
Well, I'm not sure. This is my understanding at the moment. It's not possible. I've used Protégé version 4, and in Protégé version 4 it's not possible yet. In Protégé version 3 with R1 there was something done, so it was possible. But there were warnings that the reasoners wouldn't work completely anymore if you would do that. And so basically they were using constructs from the Stanford frames approach.
Yes, yes. I know, yeah.
I'm not an expert in this area, and I'm not completely sure whether this can be done or not, and how it could be done in an elegant way.
Well, it would be very unfortunate if it is answer that way, because the whole point, or largely the whole motivation for developing L2 was to think it was possible without the word around. But anyway, I'm not absolutely certain myself. I need to go and check. Okay.
This is all I put in there just to make a start with where we are.
Okay, this is Chip again. Can you hear me, okay?
Yeah.
As I said, what I would like to do from my end is to provide kind of a similar overview of what the QUDT ontology has with respect to this, so we can arrive at a common core between the two.
Sorry to interrupt momentarily. I was on mute. It's Howard Mason. I've got to drop off the call now, but. I've updated the charter. If you refresh your pages, go take a look at it. Please send any further and final edits to me at the usual email address, and I'll get those worked in later. Thanks a lot.
And so what might be even more useful for us, Hans-Peter, is if I could produce a graph that shows the mapping between the QUDD and QUDT so that we can identify the common core of the two.
This is Hans-Peter. Yeah, I mean, that should be quite doable, because QUDV and QUDT, they come from the same origin in March this year, so should be not too difficult to reconcile.
Right. Okay. So that's unfortunately, I have nothing else to contribute at this point to this discussion, to the OWL standard discussion.
Well, I've got a question, which I, in some ways, slides on to my own presentation, which comes next, but we might as well start now. I mean, the question was just asked was about looking for a common core or an overlap, an intersection between two existing authorities. But the emphasis of the talk just before it, in many ways, was, I'll have to forgive me, I'm focused on names, was on, we heard a lot of emphasis on the way in which the theory, the ontology was very general, in which you could handle alternative notions of what counted as a base, for example. And to me, those two questions almost kind of suggest a dimension that I think I'm a little unclear about our goals. Are we trying to build an overarching general ontology into which existing models and systems can be fitted, so to speak, that acts as a kind of unifying story that they all kind of incorporate them all? Or are we attempting to sort of find something that's rather the common thing they all have in common, something rather small as opposed to something rather large or overarching? There's slightly different emphases there. For example, the first, and I'm thinking about writing all this hexagonal logic, requires one to introduce into the sort of ontological machinery ways of keeping track of different systems and nomenclature and mapping between them and so forth. Is that an issue I should be thinking hard about? It can be done, but I wonder if there's any need to do it. There would be if we wanted to, so to speak, almost incorporate as near as possible unchained existing frameworks into the standard. I wonder if anybody has any thoughts on that.
Pat, Peter Yim, could you speak up a little and also tell us when we should move over to your slides?
Oh, okay. Well, you can go to the slides now. I defer to the chair because I haven't.
Okay, Pat. So I have just a personal opinion, which is, I think, so long as we're capable of somehow describing different kinds of systems of units, I think that would suffice. I don't think it's necessary that we reproduce every previous attempt to build an ontology for quantities and measurement units. We may need to be able to reproduce some parts of, because some of them seem to be making distinctions, but other ones don't.
Yes. Actually, I didn't express myself too clearly. What I'm thinking more of is that terminology is used, you know, in some standards with a definite, fairly crisp meaning defined there, and either the same idea or a very, very close idea is used elsewhere with a slightly different name, or more dangerous, essentially the same name, like, you know, quantity type, say, is used elsewhere but with a somewhat different meaning. So do we want to be able to, in our ontology, be able to say this word as used in that ontology means this, and this word as used in that framework means that, you know, this image of ISO 8000 sense of dimension as opposed to, well, the example on my slides, if you wanted to go to the slides on my, where it says slides after my name, dimensions, but one of them, like UCUM treats angles as dimension, but the SI system doesn't. The dimension has got two different meanings in UCUM and SI. They're awfully similar, but there is a difference. Now, we could say, well, we're going to sort of decide which of these is right and exercise that. And we can say, well, no, what we need is something that allows you to say, when you use the word term dimension, whether you're using it in the UPUM sense or the SI sense, and has both senses in it, distinguished and related properly. I've been assuming that that our goal is to do this, what I call rise above them on the slides, you know, where we express both options. But perhaps that's too ambitious. Should I be being that ambitious?
I don't have a definite opinion on this yet, Peter. Pat.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Peter,
I think it's partly a question of how baroque it would be to try and do the rise above them.
It does get a little messy in the logic, in the sense that you start having kind of quantifying over names and talking about name use in contexts and so forth. Now you can put in abbreviations to make it more readable, but we found this in the IKL project, which is why I brought it up.
that we had to keep track of a name used in this context means that, and so forth.
So you're suggesting we might need to have a formal context mechanism? Or you just embed all the stuff in the names?
We could do it. We could do it either way. I mean, we've done it both ways. I mean, the W3C web way to do it, you need to embed it all in the names. You know, it's named for basically as URL prefixes abbreviated in intelligent ways. But that doesn't let you actually codify. That just distinguishes the names. Well, okay, I wondered if people were going to jump on me and have firm views, but apparently I don't hear a lot of jumping. The next slide is a kind of, perhaps I shouldn't go into this now, actually. It was just this kind of summary of the kind of baroqueness that we're going to get into. We use name conversion axioms. We did all this in IKL, and we had this notion of a framework, which was, you know, some organized, basically a namespace, some standard or context of use or something or other, which in which names are used in some definite way. So you can think of it as this being a name ontology, if you like, or an ISO standard document would be such a thing, for example. And then a UCUM would be another option. So if you want to keep track of all this different name usage, then you have to introduce these entities into the ontology of entities and talk about how names are used in them and how that usage relates to the name is used in another one. You get equations like this one here, but, you know, the SI dimension, I've made that name up, is the same as, it's the same concept as the term dimension used in the framework UCUM. So I guess I'd throw this up here just to sort of say, look, we can do this in the cliff. It gets, as you said, a bit baroque. But it does mean that you need to keep very detailed track of multiple frameworks within one overarching framework and be able to speak with great precision about exactly what that term used in that framework means relative to this term used in this framework. I mean, I think probably the best way for me to go is to do this, and then we can always sort of ignore it later if we decide to simplify things.
Yeah, Pat, I think that we may need to do this simply so that we can make clear to all the participants who may have their own frameworks already how their framework maps into what we're doing.
It's essentially a formalization of exactly that kind of explanation, yes.
And I think that there may be political advantages in terms of promulgating the standard if we do that, because then the various parties that already have something in mind can say, oh, now I understand how my stuff maps into Qomos, and then we have a Qomos namespace, for example, where we pick one that's what we're going to recommend for people to use going forward.
Right.
I
think it's helpful to do that for people right on the data line who are making tools that, you know, convert or manipulate various standards together or want to use a tool already built by people who are adopting the UCUM standard, for example. Like, they seem to have a lot of very neat software tools for solving equations and so forth. And then they can just plug those in to something else by using these name methods. That was the motivation for the development of this in this earlier project, in the ICRIS project.
Do other folks have comments on this?
Peter? Yeah. Peter Yim.
Go ahead, Peter.
Right. So I agree with the second approach. I mean, the rise above them. I mean, if it's at all doable, because complements our objective really well. In that, I mean, we aren't just trying to make a good ontology standard, but we are also trying to convince people that natural language standards should have an ontology based standard as a first class citizen. So
okay, good. That was my intuition too, but I wanted to make sure that I wasn't that I could sense the group.
Yeah, so Pat, my only concern is that if some of these existing frameworks are inconsistent with one another, then we may come to a fork in the road.
Oh, absolutely. But again, I think at that point you could just put out two ontologies, you know, or two sub-ontologies, modules, actually, better say, and say, you know, these modules are not consistent with one another. And here's why. I mean, we can document the inconsistencies very precisely.
Okay. Why don't you proceed with the rest of your slides?
It's okay. Well, the third slide, that's the only other one, is just wondering how much, again, it's a question about the sense of the group, how much latitude. I mean, we heard in an earlier presentation, the one that I was, the higher parts of the DIM hierarchy, I think, you know, our model really doesn't quite exactly fit the DIM, or any way to say. It might be an improvement. I mean, it clarifies or makes distinctions that the BIM didn't make. And I wonder how we, to what extent should we take these things as, you know, precious? How much rights do we have to override the intuitions, apparently, or the intuitions of people who write the existing standards that they're supposed to be, first basically? Can we say, we hear what you're saying, but we think you said it wrong, we're going to do it a little better? Or should we not be allowed to do that in some sense, and just take what comes exactly at face value and treat it as something that we must conform, we must put our ideas to?
I think that, I'm sort of abusing my role here as chair, but I think it depends on the standard. I think if they're, for the core ISO standards that come out of ISO 31, and I guess, I think they're now ISO 8000, is that correct?
Yes.
I think we're going to have to adhere to them or be able to incorporate them fairly literally, because those core ISO standards on measurement units are fairly well set. I think that some of the other ones are perhaps not quite as, people may differ with me on this, but are not quite as widely promulgated, and we may be able to take some liberties with them. But I suspect that Hans Peter and other folks may have different views on that. Peter, I still have your hand showing as being up. Are you trying to talk?
No, yes, Hans Peter. Peter Yim has lowered his hand already.
Okay,
this is Hans Peter. I think your approach could be that we have a base ontology which is agnostic of any kind of standard, including SI and ISQ. And then as a second level that imports the base ontology to start modeling a specific set of standards, and the first target, of course, is then the ISO 80000.
Yeah. Right. Okay. Yeah. No, I agree entirely. I guess it was more my question at the point at which we do that modeling, how we are, and Frank's really answered it. We have to treat ISO 8000 as kind of set in stone, even though there are other parts of it that some of us would have done differently. Were we there, then it would work. Right?
For example, ISO 8000, they use current as a base unit rather than charge, which I always thought was a little bit odd. That's the way they did it. We have to be able to we can't change that. We should perhaps have a framework in which one could imagine. There are other standards which use, I think CGS used charge as a base unit. And so we should be able to have a framework where we could express CGS as well. But
yeah.
I think our initial major target is ISO 80000.
Right, okay.
Yeah, but in the architecture and conceptually, we should separate the two things, I think.
Yeah, with a core that can represent multiple systems of measurement units, and then a module that's ISO 80,000.
That's correct. And that's okay. Doable.
Okay, that answers my question. Thank you. I guess my presentation is entirely of questions, but I'm being selfish here.
So you might want to do a second incarnation of that path that sort of records what we've decided here, and then maybe you can.
Yeah, I think I have it clear. Well, I'm going to store the chat room record because that's got a little longer for me. Thank you. Okay, I'm kind of done.
Okay, so I think that was the core of what we were going to talk about today. Are there other people who want to say something else before we close this teleconference? We should probably have some discussion. Peter, do you want to try and tentatively schedule our next teleconference?
Peter, I'm here. I mean, actually, that's almost my question. Do we want to, or can we, or do we... sort of defer the date of the January 14 meeting, because I posted earlier way back when Howard was speaking when he said the January 14 date is kind of tight, that January 21 and January 28 are both available dates, and if we still want to use the Thursday Ontolog slot, those are fairly precious. We could decide on something and then reserve it now. But I guess we probably want to discuss this now rather than later. Because by the time, let's say early January, and we decided that it would be best we do it on the 28th, the 28th day may not be available. So
I'm relatively agnostic, except I also need to know a long time in advance because I schedule panels, and they have a tendency, actually, Peter, to fall on either Monday, Tuesday, or Thursday, Friday, most commonly on Thursday, Friday, because many academics seem to prefer to have their panels at the end of the week because often they're not teaching on Friday. But... right now, I don't know of anything. Let me see if I know of any top meetings that are happening on those dates. But I don't know of any reason why we couldn't move it a little later if that makes Oasis happier. Does anyone else have an opinion?
I agree with what you just said.
So I mean, I guess it's consensus that the 14th is really tight. And we don't really have to stress ourselves over that. So take a pick, 14th or the move that schedule down by 14 and the 28th. I guess everyone wants some visibility, and that should be good. Preferences?
I'm trying to bring up the ACM calendar, but I'm having problems with it at the moment. Find out if there's going to be any conflict. Hang on. January 2010. Let me see if we're going to fall on top of anything.
Yeah, I really hope especially the editors can all be there. So if you are one of the editors, I mean, please say something.
Okay, so declare your preference. If we're looking at January 21st, I don't see anything. January 22nd, there's the International Conference on Agents and Artificial Intelligence in Spain, but I'm not I don't think I'll make that. So I think that I have no known conflicts in January. January 21 would work for me.
Okay. Anybody else having a preference? If not, it's chair rules. So the new tentative date is January 21st.
That's the first meeting of the TC?
Yeah. Yes, that would be sort of the TC charter meeting during which the TC is formed, I guess the chairs, I mean the initial structure, probably the editors, the secretary and things gets elected and so on and so forth. The details are in the OASIS process. So we hopefully all the key people can be there, will be there.
Hang on one second here. Let me also check my personal calendar to see if anyone scheduled me anything in there. I don't think so. Outlook is taking its time. Size mailbox. I don't see. No, there's a working group meeting or something else, but it's not anything that I care about. I'm okay. So let's just assume that we're going to do it on the 21st then?
Yep.
Okay. Do we have any other business? We may have another teleconference before then to try it. I guess the next one will be triggered when Pat or Hans Peter has a new draft. Pat, do you have a sense when that might be?
Well, hopefully by early in the new year.
Early in the new year. So sometime before the official meeting of the technical committee.
Yeah, right. I mean, first week of January or something like that.
Okay, do we want to tentatively schedule that? Peter, what is that? What have you got scheduled for Ontolog the first week in January? This doesn't have to be on a Thursday.
It does not have to be on a Thursday. Thursdays are good because a lot of people sort of reserve that date, many including myself, for Ontolog activities. I mean, if we start scheduling it on other things, it runs into conflicts with me and some people. I mean, over the years, we've debated this date. But fine, I mean, I don't have anything on the Thursday schedules in January and February now. But fairly soon, the ontology summit stuff will start hogging that calendar because the symposium, the end of the summit is early March, so a lot of summit activities will start hogging the January and February calendar. That's
the one. Is there a tentative date for that symposium?
Yes. March 15 and 16.
This might turn into a problem for me, but okay. So shall we tentatively say then that January 7th is going to be our first teleconference of the new year, and that we're going to expect new drafts.
Sounds good.
Okay.
I'll reserve those dates.
Okay. I'll put something here. January 7th, Thursday, will be our next working teleconference. Expecting new drafts of texts and models. Okay. I think with that, I'd like to wrap up the teleconference and adjourn.
Great. Sounds good.